All right. Thank you very much, everyone. I want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim partnering with Beit Midrash Dov on the program for this evening. I want to thank my friend Jeffrey Silver for helping me with some of the material for tonight. For those who just joined, please make sure that you sign in the chat. Just send me a quick note with your name. That's all you need. If you want to do it with me privately, that's fine. But I do need that, especially if you want CPD credit. If you're looking for credit, I do not record video, so I can't check afterwards to see that you were here. So please make sure that you send me a message. I do appreciate it if people have their screens on. If someone's eating dinner, I don't mind. It's a lot easier for me to talk to faces as opposed to gray boxes. So thank you very much. Our next session in the series will be Sunday morning, June 22nd, God willing, Ethical and Effective Crisis Management for Clients. That one we may be able to do, I expect we should be able to do in person finally. We'll probably keep the Zoom option. Not everybody wants to be, in person at the synagogue at 9:30 on a Sunday morning. So we'll see. We'll see how we do that. Finally, in terms of the introductions, actually two notes. Number one, some of you were actually here, as I was saying to Sergio before. Some of you were here on March 20th, 2016, when we had this, when we discussed this topic. I've since added a lot to it. It's not going to be the same one. But you can, make the comparisons yourself. Finally, Beit Midrash Zichron Udov, my program, is very happy to offer this and many other programs free of charge. When I send out the follow-up email from tonight, I'll also include a link for a campaign we're doing right now. We're dedicating a Torah, and if anybody is able to participate in that, that would be wonderful. But as always, even if people are not able to support financially, please, continue to participate in the programs. Okay. So we are going to get underway. I put the source sheet link in the chat once again. As I put at the top of the source sheet, the professionalism topic that we're talking about this evening is, the Law Society numbers it 3.1, marketing legal services in accordance with professional obligations, advertising nature of practice, advertising fees. Our topic is fundamentally competing with others for clients and the question of how to do that in an ethical way. And we're going to be talking about issues of choice of counsel, the fact that people are entitled to choose whoever they want, and we value that very much for representation. And then we're going to talk about the value of competition and the value of access to justice. And we're also going to talk about scooping, the practice of getting a client away from somebody else. That's going to be a big part of the discussion as well. When I gave this class in 2016, I started out with a source that I reread this time, and I liked it so much that I figured, hey, let's include it again. It was from the National Post. It's at the top of your source sheet, by Christy Blatchford. Article is titled, Defense Lawyer Causes Stir with Badly Written Letter Promoting Himself to Accused Killer. Mr. Leslie is the person we're talking about, the lawyer we're talking about, wrote to Michael McGregor, the 19-year-old, who along with a 31-year-old woman is charged with first-degree murder. The 27-year-old teacher, who they murdered, went missing. Her body was found in a nearby wooded area outside town on January 2nd. By the very next day, Mr. McGregor was represented by a London, Ontario lawyer who was formally put on the record. So he's got a lawyer. On January 7th, Mr. Leslie was writing Mr. McGregor, modestly singing his own praises and offering his assistance. Mr. Leslie said he specialized, quote, in difficult murder trials, and bragged in particular about two unique skills he said he possessed. One of the unique challenges in these types of cases is how to control the press, he wrote. I have had several years of experience in dealing with the press. I had made close contacts with many reporters I would endeavor to use to assist you in your case, he told Mr. McGregor, who again has representation already. Mr. Leslie also bragged about his tremendous, quotes, expertise in obtaining disclosure from recalcitrant Crown attorneys who don't provide it because, Mr. Leslie said, clearly meaning to say relevant, they feel it is not reverent. I have the resources and know how to obtain all the disclosure relevant to your case and prepare the best possible defense available, he said, adding that in relation to your charge, I have worked on similar cases such as yours. I accept legal aid. Well, I don't know if Mr. Leslie is still in practice, but my advice, and I am not a lawyer, but my advice is don't do that. Just don't do that. Aside from, you know, the problem of if you're gonna, you know, make a pitch for yourself, you should make a better pitch. But no, he's got representation already. So yeah, that's an example of what not to do. But we're gonna look now at five cases, which I gave you here on the sheet on the, on the first page. And we're not going to discuss them right now. I'm just laying out for you where we're going, and we'll take them one by one. So the first case is this. Linda is pursuing divorce from her husband. She is represented by Sarah, an accomplished family lawyer. At one stage, Linda needs to file a motion for a temporary order regarding interim child support, and Sarah is unavailable. Sarah asks her friend Wilma to file the motion. Wilma does so successfully. Linda is impressed by Wilma and asks Wilma to take over as her legal representative. Is Wilma allowed to do so? Can she take over when the client says to her, you know, I'd rather have you as my representative? We are not discussing at this point the future relationship between Sarah and Wilma, but just whether there's any ethical issue for Wilma in taking the case. That's question number one. We're also going to do number two now. I'll actually leave the other ones. I'm not going to read the other ones aloud yet, but we're going to read number two aloud because it also figures into the same discussion. Linda, now divorced and living in Toronto, is dealing with extensive litigation from her former husband. I know, shocking. Linda's cousin Michael is a family law practitioner in Alberta, but he is willing to represent Linda free of charge. Pursuant to Bylaw 4 of the Law Society of Ontario, Michael may practice in Ontario up to 100 days in a calendar year, right? It's called occasional representation. He's able to do that without being a member of the Law Society in Ontario. But the litigation is dragging on. Michael wishes to challenge the Law Society of Ontario's restrictions against practice by non-members as infringing on Linda's rights under Canada's charter by discriminating based on province of residence. By the way, this is an actual case. The names have been changed and all of that, but this happened. Does Michael have a leg to stand on? So those are the two opening vignettes. Clear so far? We're good? Okay. So let's see what we do with this. In order to start this conversation, we need to talk about choice of counsel. That's clearly, you know, very important in all of this. From the perspective of Canadian law and Ontario law, there are two basic reasons to favor maximum freedom in choice of counsel. You can take whoever you want. First of all, the working assumption in all fields of business, not just law, but anywhere, is that competition is good for the customer and for society. And protecting protecting companies or protecting businesses at the expense of consumer freedom is a genuinely bad idea. That's a basic principle which is supported in many areas, apparently not in terms of cell phones and internet in Canada. However, it's a general principle that, yes, we favor competition. So that if you take a look at source number one from the UN Conference on Trade and Development, they talk about the glories of competition. Competition stimulates innovation, productivity, competitiveness, contributing to an effective business environment. This generates economic growth and employment. It creates possibilities for small and medium-sized enterprises, removes barriers that protect entrenched elites, and reduces opportunities for corruption. All of these are benefits for the business side of things in society. And then it continues to say, competition therefore increases a country's attractiveness as a business location, triggering national and foreign investments. It also delivers benefits for consumers through lower prices, improved services, and greater choice. In this sense, competition generates total consumer welfare. We like competition, and Canada has a Competition Act, which I brought you in source number two, for two particular items that appear in the Competition Act. Number one is Section 45, which says, every person commits an offense who, with a competitor of that person, with respect to a product, conspires, agrees, or arranges to fix, maintain, increase, or control the price for the supply of the product. So if you conspire with, let's say you sell gas, and you conspire with another gas company in order to fix the price that is charged for gas, that would be, it would appear to be a violation of the Competition Act. If you conspire to allocate sales, territories, customers, or markets for the production or supply of the product, if you conspire to fix, maintain, control, prevent, lessen, or eliminate the production or supply of the product, that is an offense. And then Section 90 of the Competition Act. If on application by the commissioner, the tribunal finds that an agreement or arrangement, whether existing or proposed, between persons, two or more of whom are competitors, prevents or lessens or is likely to prevent or lessen competition substantially in a market, if there's some kind of an agreement that they are discussing which could prevent or reduce competition, the tribunal may make an order that it not go forward and that, you can look at the Competition Act for full details. But this tells us that in general in Canada, we want competition, having nothing to do with the practice of law. When you deal with the practice of law, there's a second factor. And that's what you see in source number 3. I like this source. I always bring this when I discuss access to justice. From Chief Justice Nathan Nemitz, we have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is under the rule of law one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. People have to have access to justice, and therefore, you want them to have maximum access to lawyers. That's a basic principle. Clear so far? Questions, comments? I see some nodding heads. That's a good thing. Okay. The more nodding heads I can see, the better off I am. So, again, you know, I don't mind seeing you eating spaghetti. It's really okay, and we're not recording video. So, that's in terms of the Canadian system. In terms of Judaism seems to agree on both of those points. We agree about competition in general. If you take a look at source number 4, a passage in the Talmud that deals with competition. It's a Mishnah, so you're going back a couple of thousand years at this point. And I'm reading out my English translation, but you have the original Hebrew there as well. Rabbi Yehuda said, a store owner may not distribute parched grain and nuts to children. In other words, you don't sell candy. You sell, you know, fill in the blank. I don't know. You sell widgets. You sell sprockets, whatever. And you say, you know what? I'm going to lure children in the hopes that I'm then going to get their parents to come to him as well. So I'm going to give out candy. So Rabbi Yehuda says, you're not allowed to do that. That's inappropriate competition. But the sages permit. The sages said, no, you can do that. And then Rabbi Yehuda goes on, and he says, one should not reduce the rate. And what he means by that is that in Roman society, prices were basically fixed. The Romans, one of the things they did to manage the economics of their empire was that they fixed the prices. So you say, well, I'm going to undercut the going rate. Rabbi Yehuda said you can't do that. But the sages say no. He is remembered for the good. Zachor Latov. That's just fine. You could undercut the going rate. And the Gemara there asks, what is the logic of the sages in source number 4 there? And their answer is, it will cause the rate to broaden, meaning prices will go down. If one competitor is going to reduce his prices, that will impact everybody, and we are happy about that. We want that kind of competition to happen. And in source number 5, no, not number 5, sorry, source number 6. Number 5 just shows you that that rule is in fact brought in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that you're allowed to sell for less than the going rate so that people will buy from him and the other merchants can't prevent it. But in source number 6, Rabbi Moshe Isserles says, even where we do restrict competition, that will only be in terms of non-local competitors, which we're going to come back to. He says, some say the ability of local people to protest against people from elsewhere is only where that protect. You know what? I'm not going to read out number six yet because it requires information that we don't yet have. I may come back to it later. The point that I was trying to show is simply that the what will emerge from number six is that we encourage competition, and in the event that competitors want to come from outside the community. Normally we say, you know, we don't want competition from outside the community, but if those people coming from outside the community have better merchandise or they charge less, then we say go for it. That's just fine. We like the idea of competition. We like the benefits that it provides. And then in terms of access to justice, that definitely exists within Judaism. We want everyone to be able to pursue justice. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought you from the book of Vayikra, from the book of Leviticus. I see the note in the chat where Mark asks, are you not limited in your discounting by 1/6? There is a limit in terms of either paying more than, demanding a payment of more than 1/6 over it, or undercutting as a consumer by paying less than. But the merchant is allowed to charge less. The merchant is not limited in that way. So in source number 7, if you look in Vayikra and Leviticus, when a stranger lives among you in your lands, do not abuse him. He shall be as a citizen of yours, the stranger who lives among you. You shall love him as yourself. You were strangers in Egypt. I am Hashem, your God. So everybody has the same set of rights. The local, the stranger, doesn't make a difference. Do not harm him. And we are told, the separate law, you shall have one justice for yourself, like stranger, like citizen. For I am Hashem, your God. Everybody has access to the same justice. The goal of a court is what I brought in source number 8 from the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, and the English at the top of the next slide, in which he says, there is a rabbinic injunction against a defendant who might destroy his property to restore loss. There was a rabbinic injunction in which they said, if you have a suit going on and you're afraid that the defendant, not wanting to turn over property, might destroy it, so you prevent him from doing so. And Rabbeinu Asher wrote, it appears to me there is no need for rabbinic enactment. It is straightforward law that one is obligated to save the abused party from one who would abuse him with any available strategy. In other words, if a rabbinical court sees that a defendant is going to destroy property in order to avoid turning it over, they can act on their own. I don't need some major injunction to prevent it, because the goal of the court system is to save people from being abused, to save people from being harmed. And that's an idea seen in Maimonides in source number 9 as well. We want to make sure to protect the vulnerable, which necessitates equal access. And equal access is underscored in sources 10 and 11. I'm going a little quickly because this is just introduction. But it's underscored in sources 10 and 11. Source number 10, a passage from the Talmud which says that you have a duty as a judge to hear every case, whether it involves a tiny coin called a pruta, or whether it involves 100 mana, which is a very large sum of money. It doesn't make a difference. We pay attention to the case, and we hear the case carefully, no matter what the sum is that is involved. And the same idea is in source number 11, that we should have a high standard of justice, no matter what case, no matter what kind of case we are dealing with. So the upshot of this is, and again, I went through it a little bit quickly in order to get us going, but the upshot of it is that allowing people to have choice of counsel, to say, I want to be represented by the person who I think will do best for me, whether that's they charge less, whether that's they have greater expertise, whatever it is something that the Law Society will support as competition and as helping access to justice, and it's something that Judaism will support under the same heading as well. Pausing to breathe. Questions? Comments? Yeah. Okay. Then let's go a little further. Let's go now to our first vignette. Let me just remind people, in case anybody has not yet signed in the chat, please, please make sure to do so. you can send it to me as a private message. You can do it, you know, overall. But if you want to get credit, don't rely on the fact that I saw you here. Don't rely on the fact that your name is showing on your screen. Make sure that you sign in, please. Okay. So this brings us back to vignette number one. Looking back at that case, again, Linda's getting divorced. We read it aloud before. I'm not going to read it out word for word. Now, she has representation. Her lawyer is not able to represent her on a particular point, to file a particular motion. Lawyer's not available. Lawyer has a friend take over. The friend is so good that Linda, who's getting divorced, says, you know, I'd actually like to have this other person represent me. I really liked what she did. Is there anything wrong with this new person taking the case? What would you say? No answers? This is the easy one.
The second lawyer should be approaching the first and saying, the client has asked me to take over the case. I feel uncomfortable doing that, but I wanted to let you know that. How do you feel?
Okay, so in other words, yes, they can take over, but they have to be courteous about it and perhaps smart about it.
Full disclosure and say, if you don't want me to take it, I won't, because the client is really yours. But if you feel that I can handle this, you have confidence in me, or you have other case, a heavy caseload, you don't mind giving me a little extra business, I'm happy to take it.
Got it. Okay, anybody disagree?
I disagree.
Okay, Paul, go ahead.
The client is the boss. The client can choose whomever they wish. You don't need permission from the first lawyer to switch counsel. You may want to advise them as a matter of courtesy. But you don't have to say to them, if you don't want me to represent the client, I won't.
Well,
it's the client who's of concern. It's not the lawyer.
But on a practical level, that lawyer will never get business from first lawyer again.
That's the risk they take.
So I think what Arthur...
You can shop in any drugstore you want. You don't have to go back to the same drugstore.
But can I just add something here? The situation is a little bit more complicated than that, because the first lawyer asked the second lawyer to assist in the case and to take over temporarily. So it was acting basically as an agent of the first lawyer. So the client obviously can ultimately make the choice. However, in this particular case, if the second lawyer tells the client, "Oh, okay, no problem, I'll take your case. You're the one who dictates, who should represent you." That I think he can get into real trouble from the first lawyer, because that could be considered unprofessional conduct.
So I think it's important to recognize that you're dealing on two different playing fields here. Meaning there's the playing field of the law, what do you have a right to do? And then there's the playing field of, but what's smart to do? And yeah, in terms of what's smart, and this goes back to what Arthur was saying and what Sergio was following up with as well, it may not be smart to say, well, I'm exercising my right to do this. And it's certainly from a personal perspective, not a great thing to do. Somebody sent me a note in the chat asking, what about the competency to handle the case? So I am assuming that both lawyers are competent to handle it. If you're not competent, then no, please don't take the case. I think that's certainly true. You're not doing anybody any favors, including yourself.
You wouldn't have asked them to begin with if that was the case.
I mean,
I'm with Paul. When you say that the two playing fields, to me the playing fields are, number one, your relationship with the client and your relationship with the other lawyer.
Right.
And you know best. Life is full of these kind of situations, whether you're asking your buddy to pick up your girlfriend at the airport or whatever it may be. I mean, it cuts across all sorts of things. Things happen. And if a client likes you better than, I mean, it's awkward. You may say to the, listen, I feel very uncomfortable about this because, listen, he's very competent. I think you should stick with him. But he says, no, listen, I really need whatever, you know, okay. So we can have a discussion, but certainly you don't need the first guy's permission.
Right. So I think that in terms of the law, I think we're in agreement. That from a purely legal perspective, this is what choice of counsel is about. And not only that, but the first counsel is going to have to cooperate with the switch, right? If you take a look, I brought it on the sheet in source number 12 from the Rules of Professional Conduct. Upon discharge or withdrawal, and here we're talking about discharge, a lawyer shall, among other things, cooperate with the successor legal practitioner so as to minimize expense and avoid prejudice to the client. Commentary says, cooperation with the successor legal practitioner will normally include providing any memoranda of fact and law that have been prepared by the lawyer in connection with the matter. So, you're going to have to go along with it, whether you're happy or not happy, if they decide they want to switch to somebody else. And from a Jewish perspective, the same rule pertains. I gave you a case in source number 13. Much of the Jewish law that relates to competition is expressed in terms of teachers and tutors who are hired by a family and then potentially, you know, replaced. So if you see here in the Code of Jewish Law, we are taught a teacher may not hire himself out to an employer who already hosts another teacher in his home unless the employer tells him, I don't wish to continue to retain my current teacher. If the boss says, you know, I'm not keeping the current one anyway, then you can take the job. Now, the truth is that the teaching cases are slightly different from other professional cases because you're also involved in doing a mitzvah and maybe some of the rules will change there. Some of the competency questions may come up. But what it does show here is, once the employer indicates they're not continuing with the first one, they want to switch to you, you're able to take the job. However, there is a twist. And the twist here is, what about compensation for the first counsel for the benefit that they provided? In other words, they made progress on this case before they got replaced. So the Law Society says, in source number 14, it is quite proper for the successor licensee to urge the client to settle or take reasonable steps towards settling or securing any outstanding account of the former licensee. Right? This is part of being courteous about this, but the Law Society puts it in its commentary to the Rules of Professional Conduct. You should make sure that the first guy is going to get paid, especially if the latter withdrew for good cause or was capriciously discharged. You should make sure that they're going to be taken care of. And in Jewish law, that is certainly true. And it goes potentially to an even greater extreme in terms of your responsibility. A little bit later, we're going to talk about a Gemara in Bava Basra, which I'm not bringing you the Gemara itself yet. But the Gemara is going to talk about a case in which there is competition in fishing. Okay, you have two people who are both trying to catch fish. And the case is going to be explained in a certain light in the source that I'm about to bring. The deal is, you have one party who puts out bait, and that attracts the fish. And then you have somebody else who comes to the spot, sees the fish, and grabs the fish, taking advantage of the bait that the first one put out. So in such a case, it is considered inappropriate. If you take a look at source number 15, Tosfot is actually, this one is in Kiddushin. Rabbeinu Meir, father of Rabbeinu Tam, so you're talking about the 11th century, said the case that he's talking about, the fishing discussion, is regarding a dead fish, meaning a dead fish was put out as bait. Those who are fishing place a dead fish in their nets, and the fish gather there around that fish. Cannibalism, but that's the way it goes, I guess, in the water. It's a fish-eat-fish world. And since this one spread out his net first, and via his action, by putting out the bait, the fish gather there, it is certain that if his rival spreads a net out, it's like stealing from him. In other words, the position of Tosfot is that the second competitor is not allowed to benefit from the work done by the first, from the bait put out by the first, and this is brought as Jewish law by Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, and others. And it leads to the following ruling. If you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who I always end up quoting in these sessions because he was a judge in Israel, in Beit Din, in rabbinical courts there, and he literally wrote the book, 10 volumes of it, on adjudication in Beit Din, in rabbinical court, of all sorts of issues. So he said, he quotes the Divrei Chaim. The Divrei Chaim was the Sanzer Rebbe. And it appears from the writing of Divrei Chaim that if you have a case in which the former employee cannot sue the employer, you have somebody who takes over for somebody else, and the first employee is not able to sue the employer for whatever reason, as in the case he's dealing with, the community appointed a shochet ubodek, a ritual slaughterer, and then another came and invaded his territory, and he performed shechita. So you can't sue the community, he says, to get paid for the work you did before. I'm not quite sure why, but that's what he says. Then the invader is required to pay the first for what he cost him. In other words, if you get the gig and the prior employee was not paid, and you are benefiting from the work done by the prior employee, you may be obligated to settle up yourself as the person who's coming in and taking the job away. That's extreme. That's not something that you would have seen in the law society. But what emerges here is, and then I'll take comments and questions, both sides agree that Wilma, in our case, is able to take the job. And that Wilma should make sure that Sarah, the first lawyer, is paid for her work. I shouldn't say make sure, but should urge the client. She urged Linda to pay Sarah. And in addition, Jewish law may want Wilma to actually pay Sarah if Linda doesn't do it. Clear? Okay, comments and questions.
To that too, sorry. Because there could have been a retainer taken by Sarah, and now she's going to write memos and photocopy documents and send things over to Wilma, and it's going to cost the client even more now than that client might have otherwise been willing to pay.
In other words, the first lawyer, Sarah, is going to do more work.
In order to transfer the file.
Right. Right. And she has a right to compensation for that.
Correct.
Yeah. It's true. So what do you, but I'm not following what you're adding with that.
Well, I don't know if the client's taking that into account.
Ah. Right. The client's gonna have to be aware. I guess that, you know, there's a matter of disclosure here, correct. In which, it's gonna work both ways. Meaning, you could argue that the burden is on Sarah to say to Linda, this is what I'm going to do and this is what it's going to cost you. You should just be aware of that.
Yep.
Yeah. Someone noted to me in the chat, of course, you can't leave a client in the lurch, which we've discussed a lot before. Withdrawing from representation is a whole other kettle of fish. No pun intended on our source number 15. The withdrawing is a whole other issue. We're dealing here with discharge. Okay. Questions and comments before we go further. What else? Okay, so let's see.
I think most people would feel that if their client wants to go someplace else, it's a very uncomfortable feeling. Who wants to represent somebody? You want to keep the client happy, and unless you can convince the client to change their minds or explain why this other person would not be ideal for them.
Right.
Most people would say, okay, let them go.
Right. And that's, I mean, it's true. Like, that's, you know, you do have to sort of, you know, wonder, you know, whether it's to anyone's advantage to persist and to say, well, I'm their, you know, I'm their lawyer. I would tend to agree with that. I think that's true. And that also comes up in other fields of competition beyond the law. Okay. So that was vignette number one. But now let's talk vignette number two. And again, this is an actual case. This is not just something I made up. I'm not going to read it out word for word because we read it already before. Linda is divorced now. She's dealing with litigation from her former husband. She has a cousin who's a family law practitioner in Alberta, but he's willing to represent her free of charge. Under Bylaw 4 of the Law Society of Ontario, this occasional representation by somebody from out of the province can happen for up to 100 days in a calendar year. But the litigation is dragging on, and it's going to go past 100 days. So Michael says, hey, That's discrimination on the basis of province. I should be able to represent my cousin no matter what. That's the argument that that Michael wants to make. What do you think? Does it have merit?
If the cousin from Alberta is not representing on the basis of actually being a lawyer, but just being an agent for his cousin in Ontario, therefore you don't even need a license to do that. Unless that person from Alberta is saying, I am a lawyer, I'm exercising my license to be a lawyer in Ontario,
yeah.
Then that's different.
Right, well, that's our case. That is our case. He is a lawyer. He practices family law, and he says, "Come on, let me just do this." That's the idea. I'm getting background noise from someone. If someone's not speaking, if they could mute. Anyone have a piss? Okay, so the answer clearly has to be from a law society perspective. The answer must be law societies are able to do what they do, because otherwise these rules restricting representation to members of the local bar would have been thrown out a long time ago, right? The answer is that they can restrict. The question is how this works. And the answer is that yes, we favor competition. Yes, we favor choice of counsel. However, we limit competition for the benefit of society. And that's very important. In the secular system first, before we get to Jewish law, you are allowed to restrict competition for the good of society, and that's what the law society does. They do this for a few reasons. They do it in a few different ways. In source number 17, I brought you a comment by a judge in the case of R.V. Willier. Detainees who choose to exercise their right from the charter, section 10 of the charter, their meaning their right to representation, by contacting a lawyer, trigger the implementational duties of the police. Meaning, someone's in custody of the police, they say, I want a lawyer, the police have to assist. These duties require the police to facilitate a reasonable opportunity for the detainee to contact counsel, and to refrain from questioning the detainee until that reasonable opportunity is provided. However, and this is the key, these obligations are contingent upon a detainee's reasonable diligence in attempting to contact counsel. Meaning, the fact that you have the right to choose counsel doesn't give you the right to take forever in order to do so. Such a limit on the rights of a detainee are necessary, as Lamer J, as he then was, noted in Smith, because without it, it will be possible to delay needlessly and with impunity an investigation, and even in certain cases, to allow for an essential piece of evidence to be lost, destroyed, or rendered impossible to obtain. The rights set out in the Charter, and in particular the right to retain and instruct counsel, are not absolute and unlimited rights. They must be exercised in a way that is reconcilable with the needs of society. You can't tell me I have the right to choose counsel, and therefore I could take 50 years trying to get the counsel I want. That's nonsense. That's one example of a restriction on the right to choose counsel. Another example of such a restriction is to protect a particular population, and that's what brings us back to the case at hand. If you take a look at source number 18, this is the case that we're talking about in our vignette. Specifically, the requirement there that the lawyer be a member of the Alberta Bar in a case in Alberta. So this fellow, Alan, challenges the rule that says that you have to be a member of the Alberta Bar. Mr. Allen did not refer, this is source 18, Mr. Allen did not refer to specific sections of the charter in his originating notice. One might assume, therefore, that his argument relating to his constitutional right to the counsel of his choice might also have been made with reference to section 7, section 11 of the charter. It may well be that those sections incorporate as constitutional rights many of the trial rights which the common law has assured to the accused. However, as the decision in ... has pointed out, the right to retain and instruct counsel of one's choice is subject to reasonable limits. In my view, the limitation of a choice to those counsel who have been authorized by the Law Society to practice in Alberta, so long as the substance and the process of authorization are reasonable, constitutes a reasonable limit on a right to counsel of one's choice, however that right may be defined. For the reasons I have set out above in connection with Delane's position, I am of the view that the limits which the Alberta Law Society has established in this case are reasonable. So the statement here that the judge is making is that it can be reasonable for a law society to say you have to be a member of the local bar in order to practice law here. We do restrict, even though we like competition, even though we like access to justice, there may be limits on that. Hang in there, Yechiel. Hold on just a minute. Having said that, a little bit of pushback in the other direction in source number 19, the case of Bishop. This was an interesting case. There was a case in Nunavut, and the defendant needed legal aid representation. Bishop, who was from, Bishop was the litigant in the case. But there was a lawyer from outside Nunavut who was willing to represent Bishop. And there were no legal aid lawyers in Nunavut who were willing to do that representation. The bar in Nunavut, relatively small in 2008, I don't know what it's like now, but the judge describes it in the decision as being very small. The legal aid stable of lawyers was even smaller, and the Law Society was saying, too bad, you're from outside, you're not allowed to do it. And the judge says, come on, that's nonsense. And the judge says, that's not fair. That doesn't fit the dictionary definition of choice. You need to be able to provide a selection of lawyers. If you can't do that, then really you should be letting him get representation from outside of Nunavut. So from the secular standpoint, the answer is yes, you can limit choice. However, only within reason. But the statement of you have to be a member of the local bar, that's legitimate. That will not be rejected. That's considered a legitimate limitation on choice. Yechiel, thank you for waiting. Yeah.
The topic that Rabbi has so thoughtfully chosen is ethical competition for clients.
Yes.
And I respectfully suggest that these criminal law cases with respect to choice of counsel are not nogea to the topic that Rabbi was supposed to speak about.
Oh, we ain't done.
We are, I know we aren't done, we have a limited amount of time. We are grappling with the ethical conundrum of how we as lawyers or other paralegals, other professionals, accountants, the same thing, how can we legitimately compete for clients when you are dealing with the liberty of the subject vis-a-vis the criminal law system? That's a whole different set of principles that apply in secular law, and I suspect as well in halacha. And what I'm interested to know is how does halacha deal with the problem if I can go steal Arthur Herzog's client or not, or if Arthur can come and steal.
Yeah, we're getting there. We really are.
I think you want to be there. And
okay.
Then I want to know, is there any difference in halacha and in secular law? Is there a difference where we are dealing with selling of a substantial product? I'll give an example that was no gift for Toronto years ago. Was
so we're not getting into products. We're dealing with selling and buying lawyers, not selling and buying milk.
Well, you're not
So, Yechiel, I want to get to the point of your question. Are you contending that the principles that we've set out here of choice of counsel or access to justice are limited to criminal cases? They don't apply, let's say, in a family law case? Is that your contention? No, but I'm asking, are they relevant to, in other words, is there anything that has been said so far based on these criminal cases that is not applicable to a family law situation? This is a yes or no.
Rabbi, with all due respect, I believe it is the criminal law examples are entirely inapplicable.
Yechiel, I'm sorry, I'm going to give you one more chance. Is there anything about choice of counsel that has been said so far based on these cases that is not applicable to a family law case?
Yes.
What?
Everything about
no. Which point here? I'm sorry, because Yechiel, it's taking up time from everybody in the room. Which point here is not going to be true?
Well, it's not a matter of truth.
Okay, then we're good. Then we're good. As long as it's true, then we're good. We're going to get to the other cases if you let me get to the other cases, but it is 100% correct, and I definitely acknowledge that there are differences in criminal litigation and in other areas. But on this point, and I'm not the lawyer, you are, but I don't believe there's any difference, and I researched an awful lot of cases. There is no difference. I happen to bring the criminal. They write very clearly and lucidly about this issue. But if you want, I can send you Canley listings later on, and you can look at them. I'm going weiter here. In terms of Judaism and where Judaism will fall out on restriction of competition, take a look, please, at source number 20. And this is where the fish case that I mentioned before becomes relevant. Rav Huna said, if a resident of a street establishes a mill, okay, so you have... you have a setup in which, and this goes back to urban planning in Roman times, you had houses opened onto yards, and then the yards would open onto the street. So you have somebody who is the resident of a street. He lives in one of the yards off of that street, and he establishes a mill. And another resident of that street establishes one beside the first. I want to compete. The former is legally able to prevent this. Rav Huna says, if you set up a mill first, you can stop your neighbor from setting on up as well, saying, you are interrupting my livelihood. That's Rav Huna's position. We're not going to follow it. You should just know, but that's Rav Huna's position. And the Talmud then asks, may we bring support for Rav Huna from the following ruling? Could we support his statement based on the following law? One must distance a fishing net from fish, which are already pursued by somebody else. And that's the case that we were talking about from Tosfos earlier. The distance of a fish's travel. You have to distance your net from fish that this guy is pursuing. The distance that fish travel, and how much? Is that up to a parsa, which is about 4 kilometers? So can you tell me that since there's a requirement that the second fisher has to distance from where the first one is, does that show you can't set up a mill beside the first mill? To which the Gemara says, no, they're not analogous. Fish are different, and then there's an Aramaic term which is subject to great debate. The Aramaic term is diyavi siara. What diyavi siara means is subject to great controversy, and we're going to need to understand it. The view that we brought before, that what's going on in this case is that the first fisher actually put out dead fish as a bait, says diyavi siara means it stinks, it smells bad. But that's what the first guy does. He puts out a smelly fish, it attracts the fish, and you're not supposed to come along and compete. But the conclusion of this passage here in the Gemara is that the mill case is not the same as the fish case. There is some difference. The mill case will allow the neighbor to put out a mill. The fish case, we're not going to allow you to put out the net. And in fact, that's the rule. If you take a look at source number 21, Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. the residents of a street, you know what, I'm actually going to hold off on that because it's just going to confuse things right now. Let me not go with that. Instead, I'm going to go to source number 22, which is a responsum from Rabbi Meir Eisenstadt, the Panim Meiros. He says, asked by the holders of licenses, the government would license people to practice a particular profession or a particular, to sell particular goods. So I was asked by the holders of licenses who established licenses in two villages within one region, each from a different noble. Okay? You have these people who are each licensed by different nobles to conduct business. One of them wishes to sell whiskey and beer at a lower rate than the national rate. The second one protests, saying the first one is causing him harm. They're in different jurisdictions. You have one who's in one village, you have another one who's in the neighboring village. So one of them says, I'm going to sell at a really low price. And the second one says, that's not fair, because people are just going to cross the border to buy in your village. You're causing me harm by accustoming the people of the second village to come to him and drink there, causing the second merchant a loss. And Rabbi Eisenstadt answers, the merchants of whiskey and beer can prevent each other from engaging in this conduct. There really are limitations on what one is going to do. There are limitations on your right to compete. So, you've already told me that we like competition. Why is it that we are now limiting competition in the fish case? Why is it that we are now limiting competition when it comes to the licenses? So there's a lot of disagreement on this. I'm going to bring you in source number 23. I didn't bring you all the sources. I just referenced them because I wanted to not take up too much time on this point. One view, Rav Aaron Cutler in Mishnas Rabbi Aaron, says that it's about social contract. Even though it's true that we like competition, nonetheless, we want to protect the local business because that's what the community themselves wants. The community wants to protect local businesses. That's one argument. A second argument, Rabbi Yosef Karo himself said, it's a rabbinic decree. The rabbis decided it's appropriate to limit competition in certain cases. And then the third idea, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasim Sofer, he says, no, there's a biblical verse. In the beginning of the book of Devarim, Moshe is giving instructions to judges, and he says, you shall judge righteousness between one and his brother and his stranger. Rabbi Moshe Sofer says that what this means is that it's up to the judges to judge between locals and out-of-towners, and they're entitled to be protectors of the local businesses. So the message that emerges here, and it was in 21, I like 22's framing of it better, but the message that emerges here is that we do have restrictions in order to protect the local population. And therefore, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, the halachic authorities are going to say, yes, a law society is entitled to say, we only want locals practicing here, we don't want outsiders practicing here, even though we believe in competition. Sergio, thank you for waiting.
No, I was going to just quickly mention the difference. One of the differences I see is that in the case of the fish,
yeah,
the other person is benefiting from the person who put out the fish, right? And in the case of the meal, he's not really taking anything from that person other than
Right. So you're siding with Tosfot, which we brought before in source number 15, in his interpretation of the fish case. We're going to see that Tosfot is not the only read of that case. But you're right. Within that position, that would be a clear distinction between the fish case and the mill case. In the fish case, you are taking advantage of somebody else's work. Totally agree. I want to shift gears because vignettes 3 and 4 introduce a new concept, and that is the good of the profession. The secular system is very concerned that competitive lawyers might appear, cover your ears if you're sensitive, but competitive lawyers might appear to be more concerned with profit than with altruism. Shocking, I know. But that's the concern. You know, historically, many of you know, lawyers were not allowed to advertise. And that was lifted only because of access to justice and the complaints of lawyers. If you take a look at source number 24, in terms of this good of the profession, the Law Society's rules. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means which otherwise bring, in some other way, besides the four that he lists first, bring the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. As an example, the case of Thomas Grace. If you take a look at source number 25. In November of 1988, the Law Society retained the services of Peter Campbell, investigator, to observe Mr. Grace's activities at the courthouse over a number of days. Mr. Campbell submitted a report dated December 5, 1988, in which he reports that on November 8, 1988, he attended at the courthouse and observed an accused by the name of Mr. Jean-Francois Zuguer, advised the court that he was unhappy with his solicitor and would be seeking a new solicitor. This took place in courtroom number 5. When Mr. Zuguer left the courtroom, he was followed closely by Mr. Grace. Mr. Campbell observed Mr. Grace strike up a conversation with Mr. Zuguer in the hallway and further observed the two of them then go to the cafeteria for coffee. Mr. Grace and Mr. Zuguer sat together until approximately 12 noon. The court information indicates that on November 9th, 1988, i.e. the following day, Mr. Grace appeared as counsel for Mr. Zuguer with respect to the charge. So he, you know, took advantage of the opportunity. What was wrong with what Thomas Grace did in this case? What's wrong with his actions following this guy out to the cafeteria in and getting him to switch to him? He already said he wasn't happy with his solicitor. So what's wrong with what Thomas Grace is doing? Yeah. I mean, your first point is, has to be, this is 1988. Advertising was still prohibited. Right? That's your first problem. Number two, the client still had his original lawyer. He hadn't dropped the original lawyer yet. He may have expressed dissatisfaction, but that's not the same thing as being unrepresented. And number three, it's more than advertising. This is solicitation. So there's a concern that you make the profession look bad. Now, because the halachic system does not have a legal profession, we always had, going back to the times of the Gemara, people who represented others in one way or another. So we have the idea of a morsha in the Gemara. We have something called Orchei Hadayanim. We've discussed that in other sessions. But you didn't have a legal profession. So you're not going to find anything in Judaism that speaks of bringing the legal profession into disrepute. However, you do have the general principle of concern for the honor of the Torah, which one represents. If you're dealing with somebody who represents Torah, like a judge does, maybe you have that. That's really the only analogy. But we're going to still discuss issues of competition and pursuing other people's clients in light of the secular system and its concern for competition and the good of the profession, and in terms of the Torah's views about competition. And this brings us into a discussion of scooping, pursuing somebody else's client. Take a look, please, back at vignette number 3 now, from the beginning of the source sheet. Linda, remember, is divorced. She's dealing with post-divorce litigation. Her cousin from Alberta loses his challenge to the Law Society, and Linda finds Ontario representation, so she has to pay for a lawyer. One day, Linda mentions her legal troubles to her new neighbor, Susan, who practices family law. So she has a lawyer. She mentions her problems to her neighbor. Is Susan allowed to promote her own services to Linda and say, hey, you know, I deal with stuff like that all the time? Is she allowed to make that pitch? What would you say?
Sure.
Paul says, sure. It's okay for her to do that. Knowing that the neighbor is represented. Anybody else?
Say, in your words, I do this all the time.
What do you mean?
Didn't say fire your lawyer and come with me.
Mm. Oh, I see what you mean. Saying I do this kind of thing all the time.
I deal with those all the time. Come in and have a cup of tea. We'll talk about it.
Uh-huh. Sergio, you unmuted. You wanted to say anything?
No.
Okay. Yechiel.
Yeah. I would say it's acceptable for Susan to say, if you are dissatisfied, I'm happy to give you an objective second opinion, provide me all the pleadings in the case, all the orders and endorsements, and I'll have a look at it, and I'll give you my honest opinion.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to show you what the Law Society has to say, and you guys can tell me where that falls in. Law Society in source number 27. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means that, dot, 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 D, that are intended to influence a person who has retained another lawyer for a particular matter to change their lawyer for that matter, unless the change is initiated by the person or the other lawyer. In other words, if the other lawyer says, hey, go hire your neighbor, great. If the client says, I'm not interested in my lawyer, then it goes back to our first vignette, and that's fine. But otherwise, you can't say anything that is intended to influence them to change their lawyer. Now, reading minds is difficult. But it's going to be, if there's a complaint, it's going to be up to a court to do exactly that. And to say that when you said, I do this kind of thing all the time, or when you say, if you're dissatisfied with your current, I'm glad to give you a second opinion, you know, the court is going to be the one that's going to decide what you had in mind when you said that.
But, Rabbi, yeah. I got to tell you, from personal experience, there are lawyers who do that all the time, and they have... Steer clients towards them, even though they are represented by other counsel, and they boast how great they are and how many cases in that particular, how many similar cases they're familiar with, etc., etc. And it happens all the time. It's nearly unenforceable.
Right. I can imagine that it would be very, very hard to enforce, although, take a look at the case that I think of as the James Bond case. Take a look at source number 28. You'll see why I say that. This is still Thomas Grace, who we talked about in number 25. On April 25th, 1988, Sharon Rosenberg made a written complaint to Mr. Michael Neville, president of the Defense Lawyers Association, with regard to an incident that occurred while she was duty counsel in number 6 court, guilty plea court, on April 20th, 1988. Ms. Rosenberg states that she was present in number 5 court when an unrepresented accused by the name of James Bond advised the court he wished to plead guilty. He was subsequently transferred to the guilty plea court where Ms. Rosenberg was duty counsel that morning. So she should now be the one who gets the case. Subsequent to receiving disclosure, Ms. Rosenberg met Mr. Bond in the cell block at approximately 9:45 a.m., at which time he confirmed he wished to be represented by her as duty counsel. Shortly thereafter, Ms. Rosenberg was advised by the assistant crown that Mr. Grace had approached him with respect to Mr. Bond. Ms. Rosenberg advised Mr. Grace that she was acting as duty counsel and inquired as to when Mr. Grace had spoken with Mr. Bond. Mr. Grace responded he was a friend of the family through his sister and he was acting for free. When Mr. Bond was subsequently brought into the courtroom for plea, Ms. Rosenberg discussed the matter with him. Mr. Bond advised her he did not request to see Mr. Grace, his family did not know Mr. Grace, and he still wished to be represented by Ms. Rosenberg as duty counsel. Moral of the story, if you're going to scoop, you should be better at it. Make sure you get your story straight. So there are certain complications with this. One complication which I mentioned the last time I went through this is in source number 29, and that is the issue of who exactly the client is. What happens if you have a contracting firm and they shift a client from one contractor to another? Right, number 29 I brought you, when the individual seeking legal services first retained the contracting firm / lawyer / paralegal, the individual became the contracting firm, lawyer, or paralegal's client. However, during the time that the contract lawyer or paralegal provides legal services to the same individual, That individual is now the contract lawyer or paralegal's client also. So the issue of how you determine who the contract lawyer has effectively two clients, the firm and the customer. And that was what Sergio bugged me about in 2016 when we discussed this. And that's how I learned that the contract lawyer actually has the firm and the customer as clients. I'm not really going into it. I just noted it because I knew Sergio was going to be here. But the basic principle is that in the secular system, and yes, the James Bond case, Yechiel, is also a criminal case. Nonetheless, the secular system says you're not supposed to approach people and say things that are designed to get them to leave their current representation in order to go to you. What about Jewish law? Jewish law has no concern, as I said, for the good of the profession. They're not concerned about how the profession looks. However, there is a principle that is called in Hebrew, Yored Le'umnuso Shel Chavero, which means entering somebody else's trade or somebody else's craft. And this takes us back to the fish case. We said that in the fish case, you're not allowed to set up next to the existing fish. In the mill case, you are allowed to. In the fish case, you are not allowed to. And the question is, what's the difference between the two? So one difference we gave is if you say that the first guy put out bait and the second one is taking advantage of the bait. However, I'm going to show you two other approaches now. Rashi, in source number 30. Rashi is an expert not only on Tanakh and Talmud, but also the psychology of fish. You will be amazed. Watch this. Rashi says, the fish look around, usually racing to the place where they see food. Therefore, since this person identified the fish's hole and put food within its travel radius, he is certain that he will catch it as though it had arrived in his hand, so that the rival is harming him. You know, you put out your food and the fish is going to go for your food. It's not about taking advantage of that bait. Rashi says the point is that the first person who's fishing put out the food, they're definitely getting the fish in their net. I don't know, he's never gone fishing with me. But in the mill case, one who comes to me can come, one who comes to you can come. Right? They can go to one mill, they can go to the other mill. What's the difference? The Chasam Sofer, or Moshe Sofer, sharpens the case in source number 31. He says, it's not just random fish. There is a specific big fish that this guy wants. And he already did his homework, and he found the hole, and he put out the food, and it's as though he already got it. And therefore, it's quasi-theft for you to come in and compete with him for that fish. That's the way the Rabbi Sofer looks at it. Ramban, Nachmanides, is even stronger in source number 32. He says, I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem in the fish case is that the fish is actually in the net of the first fisher. The fish is actually in the net, still able to escape, but it's right there in the net. And therefore, Nachmanides says, it is full-blown theft for you to lure the fish out. It was sitting in the guy's net. That's the issue. So what that means is there's no real prohibition against competition here. The prohibition is against theft, taking away something that the other guy already has. But in our case, that's what we're talking about, right? This person is already represented by somebody. Sharon Rosenberg is representing James Bond. So you can't now take Bond away from Sharon Rosenberg. And if you take a look at, now I'm going to come back to the passage that I skipped before. It was in, hang on. No. Where did I have it? It's source number 13, not one that I skipped before. It was source number 13. We ruled in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, a teacher may not hire himself out to an employer who already hosts another teacher in his home unless the employer has actually dropped the first one. But otherwise, you don't get to do that. That's the idea. This is like theft. So what we're saying here is, From a secular perspective, there's an issue of the good of the profession. From a Jewish law perspective, this is considered inappropriate competition. You can't take away somebody else's existing customer. Now, you're still allowed to advertise your services, right? Advertisement is still going to be allowed in Jewish law and in recent decades in Canada as well. Why is that okay? So, 2 points on that. Source number 33, a comment from Rashi in 11th century France, talks about a passage in that same discussion about the fish in the Talmud, where the Talmud says outside competitors are allowed to invade and compete locally, where it is a global market, where there's a market day, like Rashi notes in source number 33, and people come from everywhere. Where there's an open market and anybody could go to anyone, then sure, go ahead and compete. That's not what we're talking about in the case of having someone who's already represented. Further, you can advertise in general, even though people who are represented are going to see your ad, because you're not targeting them. You're advertising to the world. This guy happens to see the ad. That's not your problem. That's source number 34, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau. He says, you're allowed to publicize your services. That's not an issue. It's not directed to this particular client. Okay. So in vignette number 3, each system is going to say, no, you may not intentionally pursue somebody who is already represented by somebody else. But now let's look at vignette number 4. Vignette number 4, it takes us back to, again, a scooping case, but not quite the same. James is pursuing divorce from his wife. We're done now with Linda. Linda's hopefully doing just fine. James is pursuing divorce from his wife. James has had a preliminary meeting with a lawyer, but has signed no agreements. James mentions his case in conversation with his neighbor Shira, who practices family law. Is Shira allowed to promote her own services to James? Is it okay for Shira to promote her services to James, who has had a preliminary meeting with a lawyer? What would you say?
Yes.
I got a yes. I can't hear who said...
Sure, why not?
Yeah, that's the basic. Here, this is finally a case in which Jewish law and the secular law come to different practical conclusions. From a secular perspective, absolutely nothing wrong. I can't even find anything in the literature that discusses this issue. Of course you can. From Jewish perspective, we're not so comfortable under two different headings. The first heading is what's called Ani Hamahapech Bacharara, which literally means a pauper who is pursuing a cake. And the issue is that I am not allowed to take something if a needy person has already expressed interest in it. If you take a look at source number 35, a passage from the Talmud, Rav Gidol, one of the sages, was trying to acquire a certain plot of land. By the way, I'm just going to note, since we have 15 minutes left, if anybody did not yet sign in and they want accreditation, you do have to make sure to sign in. If you signed in already, don't worry about it, you're good. Rav Gidol was trying to acquire a certain plot of land, but Rabbi Abba purchased it first. Rav Gidol complained to Rabbi Zeira, who complained to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha. It's going all the way up the chain. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha asked Rabbi Abba, where a pauper is pursuing a cake and another person takes it from him, what is the law? And Rabbi Abba replied, he is called wicked. You're not allowed to take the cake that somebody else is pursuing. That makes somebody a Rasha. That makes somebody wicked. That's a very serious charge in Jewish law. Like the Talmud talks about reprisal. If somebody calls you wicked, what you're allowed to do in response to them. This is a very strong statement that he's being called wicked. Nonetheless, that's what the Talmud says. So much so that Rabbi Shlomo Luria, in source number 36, in 16th century Poland, says it's up to the rabbinical court to decide whatever penalty they want to give to somebody who takes the cake instead of leaving it for the pauper. Now, I should note, and Rabbi Moshe Isserles in source number 37 notes it, that this is actually not entirely true. Meaning, Rabbi Moshe Isserles notes in his quoting Tosfos that it depends. The item that you are pursuing, that the pauper was pursuing first, is it something that you could get anywhere? Like, you don't need to take what the pauper was pursuing. You could have gotten it anywhere. If it's something you can get anywhere, then yes, you do not have the right to go take it, and taking it is wicked. However, if this item is unique, it's uniquely valuable, it's uniquely available, then you are allowed to take it because you're just as needy as this other person. It's not available anywhere else. So, in terms of this particular argument, the argument of pursuing the cake, we may well say, if the first lawyer is already trying to get the client, and this client is not in some special way unique or different, then no, you don't have the option of doing so. And I'm going to make the case even further. The second case that the second heading in Jewish law is called Ani Hamanakef Barosh Hazayis. And what that means is a pauper is banging an olive tree at the top of the tree. The classic way to harvest olives is you go up the tree, you bang the branches, the olives fall down, and then you collect the olives. So what happens if you have somebody who goes over to an olive tree on public land? It's not anybody's property. And the pauper goes up there and is banging away at the olives, and you come along, and you see the olives on the ground, and you say, amazing, olives! And you start loading up your bag with olives. So the Talmud says, source number 38, it's a Mishnah, Ani amanakef barosh hazayis, if a pauper is striking atop an olive tree, taking that which is beneath him is theft, due to the ways of peace. The first view is, really, the pauper, the guy at the top of the tree doesn't own it. He didn't acquire the olives. But we really, really don't want you doing this to people. It sort of goes back to Arthur Herzog's point in the beginning about, you know, how you conduct yourself, even if you have the legal right to take something, the legal right to take a client. You may want to be smart. Rabbi Yossi says no. He says, of course that's theft. You're not allowed to take it. You're benefiting from this other guy's investment, right? Think about the fish case. So as a matter of practice, it depends on how much strain the first person put in. Meaning, they had a meeting with a potential client. That's not a lot of strain. They created a proposal with 2 weeks of work. That may be a larger amount of strain. Rabbi Shlomo Luria notes that in source number 39, it depends a little bit on how much investment they've actually made. And there's no penalty in a human court for doing this. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in source number 40 says if somebody comes along and takes the olives, it's not fully theft, such that they could be removed via judges, but he has sinned and God's going to punish him. That's the way that Rabbi Epstein looks at it in source number 40. But the point that I'm trying to make and that I hope is coming across clearly is that secular law says this guy who made the presentation first has no claim on this client. Jewish law is saying we really don't want you to compete unless there's something unique and special here and the first guy didn't invest that much in it. But the halacha, Jewish law, will go far beyond what the law society protects. And I think the reason why Jewish law will go beyond what the law society protects is go back to the two principles that I invoked here. The pauper who's pursuing a cake and the pauper who's hitting the top of the tree. Emphasis on the word pauper, right? That's what we're talking about. The general Talmudic philosophy of all employment, law, like any other, is that the worker is looked at as needy, sacrificing time, sacrificing health in order to make money. The professional sells her time and expertise in order to survive. If the professional weren't needy, they wouldn't be selling their life for their money. The fact that you're doing this, instead of, you know, pursuing your hobby, instead of relaxing, instead of being with your kids, you're out there working, is because you are needy. That's the way that Jewish law traditionally has looked at employment. The ideal? is you have your own grapevine and your own fig tree, and you farm your own field, and you don't worry about working for somebody else. You're working for somebody else, you must be needy. That's the assumption going in. And we don't want people taking advantage of somebody who is needy. And there's a lot to support this. I brought you sources 41 and 42. Maimonides talks about getting somebody a job as the highest level of tzedakah. He says, you know, if you have a job to hire somebody for in your household, you should hire needy people in order to make sure that you're providing for them. Employment is viewed as a form of tzedakah. It's a form of assistance. That's the way that it's looked at, and therefore Jewish law will act a lot to protect. Sorry?
The other guy is also a honey.
Yeah, and that's why Tosfos says... No, you're right. That's why Tosfos makes the comment that if it's something unique you couldn't get elsewhere, then indeed you're entitled to... you're entitled to compete for it. That's true. That's very true.
Why is it something unique?
Because that's what makes it fair for you to come in where the first pauper was. Otherwise, yes, you're a pauper, he's a pauper, but he was there first. We don't want you taking his tzedakah away from him. That's the idea. It's not a modern way of looking at it. This is not the way that the world tends to look at it. But it
generally does not work in the real world.
Okay. I'm good with that. Don't worry, Michael. I like you. But that's on this case. I would take comment, but I want to make sure to get to the fifth vignette. So let's make sure we can get through that one. That one I only brought a little bit about, not a whole lot, because I didn't think we'd have that much time. So if you take a look at source number 5, Sally comes home from a business trip to find out her husband has pawned her jewelry to cover a gambling debt, which he had run up in trying to pay for his secret drug habit, which he had begun during a year-long affair with Sally's sister. Traumatized, she knocks on her neighbor Shira's door to ask if she could sleep there overnight. Shira practices family law. May she offer Sally her business card? What would you say?
Sure, why not?
I hear a sure why not? Well, the Law Society says no. The Law Society says don't do it. If you take a look at source number 43, I mean, don't do it that night, is what I should say. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means that take advantage of a person who is vulnerable or who has suffered a traumatic experience and has not yet had a chance to recover. And then the commentary in source number 44, a person who is vulnerable or who has suffered a traumatic experience and has not yet had a chance to recover may need the professional assistance of a lawyer. This rule does not prevent a lawyer from offering their assistance to such a person. A lawyer is permitted to provide assistance to a person if a close relative or personal friend of the person contacts the lawyer for this purpose, and to offer assistance to a person with whom the lawyer has a close family or professional relationship. The rule prohibits the lawyer from using unconscionable or exploitive or other means that bring the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. So it doesn't mean that she can't ever get a lawyer, or that she can't get a lawyer that night. But it has to be done in a way that will not take advantage of her vulnerability. This is not about the client making bad decisions. I should be careful about, to say that. This isn't about the client making bad decisions. That's a separate problem. The issue here is just the appearance of the profession. In a Jewish law setting, absolutely, you're not allowed to take advantage. We have a principle of lifnei iver. You're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of the blind. I'm watching the transcription here. We have a principle of whatever that said. Lifnei iver, if you take a look at source number 45, passage from the Torah, do not curse the deaf and do not put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall revere God. I am God. And from that we understand that you can't give people bad advice. Source number 46, if someone asks you for advice, do not advise him inappropriately. Do not tell him depart in the early morning such that thieves will attack him, or depart at noon so that he will be overcome by heat. Now, I should have brought more of this source. I actually stopped short. They also mention you shouldn't advise the person to sell land in order to buy a donkey, like the donkey that you have for sale. They, in other words, you stand to gain from it is really what I should have brought here. That was a mistake not bringing that there. You can't give advice which is bad for the person in order to help yourself. And this includes when you're dealing with somebody who is vulnerable. If you take a look at source number 47, the last source on the sheet, Maimonides writes, God instructed, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. This refers to someone who has been blinded by desire or bad ideas. Do not aid him toward his blindness, leading him further astray. So in other words, even if they believe this is what they want, but they believe it because they are vulnerable, you can't take advantage. Now, the truth of the matter is that in reading these sources, I'm actually noting that there's a problem in the Jewish law sources I brought. Because none of them deal with the question of, what if this isn't bad advice? You're a fine lawyer. They need a lawyer. Right? So I think that actually from a Jewish law perspective, you actually are allowed to pursue it if you are confident to represent them in this field. And of course, that is our assumption in the cases that we're dealing with. If you are a competent lawyer in that field, you're able to pursue pursue their business. The law society will say, we want you to preserve the appearance of the profession and make sure that you go through somebody else, or you have to have a relationship, or you have to wait till they're no longer in this traumatized state. The law society, I think, will actually be more cautious than Jewish law in this case. Clear?
Rabbi, is being served with a statement of claim a traumatic experience?
I think it can be. No? What would you say?
Well, if you've been served with a statement of claim every day for the last month, I would say no. If this is the first time you've ever been served with a statement of claim, it might be a traumatic experience. So, when you serve with a statement of claim and your neighbor's a lawyer, you go knocking on his door.
Mm-hmm. So the answer would have to be, going back to the language of the Law Society in their commentary, if this is somebody who is a personal friend, it's the neighbor, you know, and they contacted you as the lawyer, I think it's fine. You didn't use unconscionable or exploitive means at all.
Right.
So I think that's fine. I think the Law Society is good with it.
One person might not be traumatic to another person.
Right. No, I think that's a fair statement. Yeah. Okay, other questions and comments? Yeah, she just wants to be somewhere else that night. Correct.
Like you said, it's not necessarily bad advice. Imagine somebody comes to you with such a terrific story, and as a neighbor, you probably know more about what's going on than maybe people down the street. And when you hear this horror story, you go, okay, we know that enough is not really going to do something.
Right.
But I guess the Law Society is more concerned the image of lawyers than they are with...
Well, they made it very clear.
Situation.
They made it very clear that that's what their concern is. Their concern is not to bring the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. That's what they're concerned about.
How is the administration of justice going to be brought into disrepute when this person is probably, I would imagine, demanding, I need a lawyer, and her card, she may or may not hire her.
Right.
I mean, she knows, she already knows by the time she's going into the house that she's a lawyer. So.
Right. I mean, to me, based on the things I've read, the best strategy is to say to her, listen, I am a lawyer, this is actually my field, and I'm going to give you my card, but you haven't retained me. You know, come to my office on Tuesday, and then we can have a conversation. You know, something like that. Give her the time to breathe.
Right, exactly. But there's nothing wrong, per se, with giving her a car or advising her. I practice in that field.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. This was fun.
I'm surprised I almost brought up the fact that the Law Society should be concerned about that, because it's way too late for that.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it. I'm glad you said it.
But I don't.